This week, we continue an article on the Great Pyramids at Giza and discuss their significance and what their possible use was. Can we reconcile both a place of initiation and burial? Then we're going to dive into the science of colors in our search for meaning in the colors of Freemasonry. What do the colors blue, red, yellow, green even mean? We've got a special guest, Roy G. Biv, to explain it all. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 498. Just a couple episodes away from 500 episodes. Nothing crazy is happening for our 500th episode. I know it's kind of weird we did something big for our 100th because, you know, hey, who does 100 episodes? Well, it's a few years later. We've got almost 500 episodes out. And you know what we're focused on? Maybe not such a big 500th episode show, just continuing the mission of bringing great Masonic education to anybody interested in learning about it. So let me thank those people who helped bring us 500 episodes. That's right, those are going to be those people who support this show, our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners who have worked with us for years, in some cases, to continue bringing the Masonic science to the masses. This also includes anybody out there who shares our stuff on social media, tells a lodge brother about it, or tells somebody about it who might be interested in Freemasonry, or maybe you're just somebody who decided to throw us a couple bucks one month. You know, all of you out there really helped bring this program to us, and we've been doing it for just about 10 years now, which is crazy, but I'm so grateful that we've been able to do it, and I'm also grateful to be the one who brings this out to you and to continue doing this great work. It's a really big honor. So thank you to all of those people. In the news, of course, I just want to mention that we have our books. They'll be shipping really soon. Max Heindel's Ancient and Modern Initiation Special Edition is out, of course, in paperback, hardcover, and on Kindle. So if you're interested in any of those, please don't hesitate to check them out. Hardcovers are going to go through Amazon exclusively. Kindle is, of course, through Kindle. And you can also get the paperback via Amazon. But if you'd like an autographed edition, you can order that right on the WCY Podcast website, WCYpodcast.com. Click on the shop and check out how you can get your copy there. You can also get your copy of the Master's Word Annotated Edition, which John Roark and I worked on and is receiving high praise from a lot of folks. Humbled by that, of course. If you're interested, that also can be purchased through Amazon. You can get it Kindle or on hardcover also. The hardcover is a newly condensed book. We actually condensed it quite considerably, so it's actually more the size that the original book was, only in hardcover, which good luck finding your own hardcover of that original. It's pretty difficult to find and very, very expensive. We've got a great alternative, and we've provided some great insights for you. So if you're interested, head on over there, check that out, as well as any number of the other books that we've put out. I've also got the How to Charter a Lodge. A lot of lodges are getting back to work now. And if you're curious on what it takes to start a lodge, how to find the people you need to start a lodge, and what to expect when you're going to do it, it's a good book to start with. Now, last week we ended the episode number 497 by reading an article called The Pyramid at Giza in The Initiates and the People, a publication that was published in the early 1900s, took a little break, and then came back 12, 13 years later, I believe. Don't quote me on that, but it ended with a to be continued. For those interested in hearing the first part, go ahead and load up episode 497 and listen to the latter half of the episode, just after illustrious Brother Harrison's Masonic Minute. The Great Pyramid, a Temple of Initiation Continued from Last Month. That's the quote on the article title. The soul within him has become a sun of light and life. Its rays fall upon the temple, the purified body, and there is neither shadow nor darkness. Man can reach this state only through living the exalted life, and by enduring the tests and struggles and experiences necessary to the purification of his gross, vile, and unjust nature. Corresponding to the fact that the Great Pyramid stands at the center of the land surface of the earth, it is to be impressed upon the sincere seeker that the physical seat of the soul in man is likewise situated at the center of his physical frame, thus giving him greater advantage, power, and possibilities. In this respect, again, there are significant correspondences between the body of man and the Great Pyramid. Each is a temple, the one a temple of living, throbbing, pulsating flesh and activity, the other a temple of stone, inanimate, stationary, which, however, signifies, in its form, the vital significance of the temple of flesh and blood wherein dwells the divine fire. The temple of stone is perfect in its dimensions and proportions, in its appointments and mechanical structure, in all its details, however minute. For this reason, it has been able to withstand the ravages of time. Here again, it fitly symbolizes man, for when he shall have attained perfection, illumination of the soul, he shall possess the qualities and essences that endure for all time. He shall have reached conscious immortality, the eternalization of his soul. Why should the Egyptian temple of initiation have been built in pyramid form? Why not conical? If pyramidal, why of four sides rather than of eight or some other number? As a four-sided structure, the Great Pyramid is a perfect symbol of man in his four natures. The fourfoldness of man's being was clearly understood by the priest initiates of Egypt, and throughout the neophyte's entire training they had this in mind, giving the most careful thought to the proportionate development of each department of man's nature. Man is composed of body, mind, spirit, and soul. When he so lives as to harmonize these four natures, he becomes the whole, or holy being, for which Masonry sought, the four square, city of our God, the end and the aim, the goal and the reward, placed before man is to bring his fourfoldness into unity, or harmony. When he has accomplished this, he has ascended to the plane of deific consciousness. He has become in truth as one of the gods. His body has attained the status of a temple for the living, ever-present God. As the Great Pyramid was to the initiate priest a temple upon which the heavenly sun could shine without a shadow, so is the body of man a temple of flesh, material substance, in which the soul, the sun of man's heaven, interiorly illuminated through the harmonizing of his fourfold being, may radiate throughout the entire being without a shadow or dark, quote-unquote, evil reflection. The recurrence of the number four in nature's domain is significant and emphasizes the wisdom symbolized by the pyramid of four sides. There are four seasons, four cardinal points, four kingdoms that hold sway in nature, the mineral, vegetable, animal, man included, and spiritual. The spiritual kingdom is seldom recognized as a separate kingdom, for the reason that it does not function as an entity to be separately discerned by the eye of flesh. As far as man is concerned, the spiritual kingdom or division is the most important of all, since through it, man is offered continued existence, if he will avail himself of the opportunity and meet the requirements. Furthermore, man himself is usually thought of as a threefold being, the soul or immortalizing element in him not being recognized as an internal part of his composite nature. From these and other points of view, the Great Pyramid, four square on its ancient foundation, corresponds to the fourfoldness of the nature of man. In the Great Pyramid, the four sides were joined into or met in one point in the apex, and thus it became a temple enclosure. In its exterior proportion, equality and symmetry are manifest in every detail. The base is a perfect square. The four sides, triangular in shape, are perfectly equal one to the other. The triangular faces ascending gradually, terminating and uniting in an apex that is the same for all. How beautifully this form symbolizes the ideal placed before man, the ideal of equalizing and harmonizing body, mind, spirit, and soul, and of creating by means of this symmetrical development a structure that terminates in unity and is glorified by the sun or light of the illuminated soul, which itself resulted or was born as the crowning glory of the development of this fourfold nature. Such is the ideal temple, perfect in symmetry and proportion, upon whose four sides the sun shines, casting no shadow. The door of the Great Pyramid is in the north. Why should this be so? The sun of the physical world rises in the east, travels by way of the south, and sets in the west. It does not pass by way of the north. For this reason, in all lodges governed by exact law, the seat of the Supreme Master in the east, and all officers pass by way of the south to the west, and thence to east again. The north is emblematic of coldness and death. No normal man knowingly or purposefully invites death. He seeks wisdom and light and warmth. He, who entered the great Egyptian temple in the very act of entering, turned his back once and for all upon the north with its coldness, its darkness, and its ignorance, and faced the south with its warmth and sunshine, and its power to give life and happiness. Even the outward act of entrance into the material temple symbolized the mental attitude that must characterize the neophyte of the temple. He must forever turn away from and give up those things which lead to death. Immediately upon entering the temple, he turns toward the east, seeking wisdom and true understanding, journeys by way of the south, and finds kindness and mellowness of disposition, proceeds toward the west, where he reaps ripeness of experience, and again turns to the east, where he expects the sun to illuminate the whole temple, or the being. This process he repeats, each time giving up more fully those things which lead to death, more eagerly seeking deeper wisdom and truth, partaking more deeply of love and generosity of spirit, becoming riper and more mellow in graces of the heart. Eventually, if its journeys are successful, he becomes master of his own kingdom and takes his seat in the east, or the center of the supreme hierophant of his own temple. For in the end, he will have worked out the proper proportions, have equalized and perfected the four departments of his being, his consciousness, partaking equally of the four natures that he represents, will ascend into the apex of unity of his entire nature, eliminating all diversity, and with the sun of righteousness or illumination shining in his soul, there will be within him no variableness, neither shadow of turning. Strange as it may appear, through the continued process of development or initiation, when man has rounded out his fourfold being, he has succeeded in accomplishing the seemingly impossible. He has, quote-unquote, squared the circle, or made a perfect circle out of a perfect square. His fourfold nature is crowned in unity. Of this four-in-one circle, there must be a center, symbolized in masonry by the dot in the circle. The circle actually represents the perfect man. The symmetrical being becomes such through deliberate conscious effort to live and manifest the exalted life. In time, the dot, the center around which the circle is formed, becomes personified, and through illumination, the sun of the soul rises to view, and man has attained the plane of the gods. The Egyptians regarded the earth as a sphere. They knew that the radius of a sphere and of a circle must be a certain proportion to its circumference. They therefore constructed the quadrangular pyramid of such a height in proportion to its base that its perpendicular would be the radius of the sphere equal to the perimeter of the base. Such was the practical symbolical application of ancient geometry. And here again, we have an accurate representation of man in his perfect state. According to the analogy, man's four natures are symbolized by the cube. Through the process of harmonizing his four natures, the corners are gradually rounded and smooth, become absorbed or transmuted, until man becomes spherical rather than cubical. As through purification the spherical surface supplants the cubical, his nature becomes transparent, and the dot at the center in the form of a fiery light comes to view. This indicates another phase of the rounding out of the square. In these various particulars and proportions, the builders of the Great Pyramid symbolized to countless generations which were to come the perfect man, result of a symmetrical development, and the Great Pyramid stands as an enduring monument to the superior wisdom and learning of the Egyptian priests, who so fully comprehended these sublime mysteries regarding the nature and destiny of man. Throughout the universe, all of nature, in all things that exist, operates the law of Hermes. As above, so below. As there are spiritual laws, laws governing in spiritual states, so there must be natural laws, laws governing everything in nature, harmonizing or prototypic of the spiritual laws. In time to come, as men more and more proceed toward perfection, the laws that rule and regulate the visible manifestations of God will be made to correspond to the laws that govern the invisible hierarchies and Elohimic spheres. In all practical inventions and labor-avoiding devices on the material plane, man makes use of the laws of the universe, the laws of nature, the laws of proportion and adaptation in the human organism. The Great Pyramid stands as a constant reminder to those who understand of the one mighty law of the universe, which, in its myriad ramifications and forms, operates on all planes, including the invisible hierarchic and Elohimic planes, as well as the physical and material. It was because of this tremendous and all-significant fact that the ancients inscribed over their temple entrances, "Man, know thyself." These masters were fully aware that if man thoroughly understood himself, his own nature, his possibilities and capabilities, as well as his weaknesses and passions, he would understand the universe and everything functioning in it. For man is himself a perfect prototype of the universe. Aye, even does he within himself contain an image of God. Mark well. This truth is not applicable to poor, carnal, fallen human nature, but to man when he has redeemed himself for his low estate. In proportion to the resumption of his lost estate is man that prototype of the universe. In his possibilities, he represents the universe and may cooperate with the universal laws. The Great Pyramid as a symbol of perfection has yet other meanings. In particular, it was to the Egyptian initiates an emblem of eternal life. The Egyptians were in advance of all other peoples in their belief in an eternal life or the immortalization of the soul. Their philosophy and their science had in view one object above all others, the perfecting of man into the image of the Creator God. The training of neophytes under the priesthood aimed at bringing the divine spark in man to such a degree of dynamic consciousness and activity that death need not be the end of man's existence on earth, but rather that continued and conscious life should be the reward or the natural and inevitable result of his earthly pilgrimage. Even the Egyptian art of embalming was for the especial purpose of holding the soul to the beloved Egypt, that it might reincarnate in that land of sunshine and wisdom. To the Egyptian, death or the cessation of physical life was merely a passing to another sphere of activity, where the soul should be judged and receive sentence according to its deeds while in the body. There could be, they believed, no intercession or vicarious atonement. However, the unperfected soul always was given another opportunity to return to earth for the purpose of continuing its work of self-purification and for the payment of debts incurred in a previous life. Justice, exact and undeviating, was the law. There could be no evasion. Each soul had to pay the utmost farthing of its indebtedness before it could obtain full freedom. This principle of reincarnation or re-embodiment was the basis of the Egyptian custom of embalming their dead. Embalmment was not, however, as commonly thought, with the idea that the particular body should be re-inhabited, but rather that the body would serve as an unbreakable link connecting the soul with the former earthly home, which would ultimately summon it back to that home. The custom was based on the law or principle that everything man touches receives a part of his personality. What stronger attracting force to a soul could there be on earth than the carefully preserved body which it inhabited? Another misconception prevalent even among scholars is to the effect that the Egyptians believed that unless the body was preserved through embalming, the soul could not return to the earth plane. The basic reason for the embalming of the body, as already partly explained, was that to the Egyptian, Egypt was practically a paradise. Therefore, his deepest wish was that he might return to his own country. The Egyptians well understood the law that so long as the body of a man remains preserved, the soul is held or bound to the place or near the place of its former existence. Every Egyptian of high birth, loving his country, thus desired to return to that country and to none other. Within the Great Pyramid, there were three chambers of importance: the king's chamber, the queen's chamber, and the antechamber. The chamber of the king answered a double purpose. It was a sepulcher for the bodies of the initiate kings, and it was used during ceremonial initiations. The antechamber was the actual ritual chamber of initiation. Here is found the sacred coffer or coffin. Here, the neophyte passed through the tests and the ordeals required to determine his fitness for entering upon training for initiateship. At the end of a long probation, he was placed in a sacred coffin, remaining there for a number of days without food so that he might become free from impurities, whether of thought, desire, or substance. Not that it was possible to effect a complete purification during this probationary stage, but the experience served as an impressive symbol of the giving up of everything that is carnal and destructive in its nature, and which would prevent the ultimate object of attaining illumination or soul consciousness, which was the ideal of true initiation. After passing through the various tests of the probationary stage, the neophyte was admitted to the path that actually leads to initiation. This is symbolized by the beginning of the erection of the temple structure. The final overcoming is represented by the completion of the temple, at which the Great Pyramid, man, has his apex directly under the rays of the sun, the fire rays of his own illuminated soul. Why should the Great Pyramid have been used for a double purpose, burial and initiation? Why not have had two buildings, one for each purpose? It is to be borne in mind that only those kings who had become initiates could be buried in the Great Pyramid. The priests, not the kings, held the keys. It must also be remembered that the Egyptian priesthood understood the laws governing the hierarchic rulership in the universe. They believed in the one true God as ruler over all, yet they associated with him lesser subordinate powers, just as we associate many lesser officials with the president of a republic. These lesser powers the priests called hierarchies or Elohim, one of these being in charge of every department in heaven and on earth. The initiate priests made use of an elaborate system of hierarchic invocations, which brought them into direct touch with the hierarchies. This was a continuation of the most ancient magician religious practice. These initiate priests used a system of invocation for all worthy purposes, more especially for the healing of the sick and the afflicted among the people to whom they ministered, the priests being also the physicians of Egypt and all treatments taking place in those temples. Thus, in a sense, the initiate priests were co-workers with the hierarchies and served as channels or avenues through which the hierarchic power could reach the needy. When an initiate priest attained proficiency in the art of invocation, hierarchic help was at his command, and as the soul is the agency of command, death of the body did not sever his connection with the hierarchic sphere. The soul, having attained an exalted degree of consciousness, retained its hierarchic power and connection, and for this reason the Chamber of Kings was a sacred place, potent by reason of its celestial influences and association. We will finish up this article next week. Quite an interesting piece. There's a lot of explaining the ideas of initiates and their role in the Egyptian caste system. And also, I really sense a little bit of the influence of Manly P. Hall's book, The Lost Keys of Freemasonry. Now, of course, this issue came out in 1929. The Lost Keys of Freemasonry was originally published in 1923. So it is fair to say that there is likely a bit of influence here that is coming through. I don't want to ask a question about this particular section that we're reading. However, I would definitely invite anybody with commentary on this particular section to go ahead and leave it in the Craftsman Plus Facebook group. The reason I don't have a question for it is because I think up to this point within the second half of the article, or not even half really, it's more of like a one-third part of the article, is that they're building a case for something. And they are speaking in quite an etheric way. I'm not sure that they've actually said much of anything yet. There's a lot of reiteration and poetic verse that's happening. And that is just the writing style of the day. Nothing against that in that time. I would say that I would avoid that kind of language today, unless you're a poet. Next up, I wanted to talk a little bit about the science of color. Recently, I got a brother who sent me a Facebook message, and he asked about the science of color. And he said, what are the colors of Freemasonry? And I initially thought, well, of course, the Blue Lodge, and of course, green for AMD, and maybe red for commandery and white and black for commandery also. Scottish Rite has got, you know, colors that are somewhat associated with different things. Rosicrucianism is associated with red, right, and rose, and all of these things. And that's all well and great. But what is the real story behind the color? So I got this message, and no sooner had I found myself at the local Barnes & Noble, and I looked to my left, and there sat a book on the shelf called The Secret Lives of Color. I thought, that's kind of serendipitous. So I picked it up. $20 book, great, cool book. I think you can get it on Amazon. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But it's written by Cassia St. Clair, and the book was published, I believe, back in 2017. Actually got an award, and NPR gave it one of the best books of 2017. I immediately dove in once I got home, and I became very captivated by the science of color. And I've learned quite a bit just in that little bit of reading. But what do we know about the science of color? What do we know about the history of color? Let's dive into a little bit of that. The history of color and the colorful science behind it. You could say that how we see color has been colored by years of history, culture, and scientific endeavor. This was published on sciencefocus.com by Gavin Evans on the 28th of October 2019. He says, "The rainbow used to have just five colors, until 1704 when Sir Isaac Newton added orange and indigo to the list simply because he had a fondness for the supposedly mystical properties of the number seven. In fact, there are no pure colors in the rainbow. They all blend into one continuous spectrum, but ever since Newton, we've settled on seven and used little rhymes to remember them. Americans favor Roy G. Biv, like red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet, while British children might learn Richard York gave battle in vain, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. Attentive children might therefore be perplexed by the song I Can Sing a Rainbow, which begins red and yellow, and pink and green, purple and orange and blue. So it would seem that the colors of the rainbow can differ, and when we dip into the cultural histories of these colors, we see even wider differences. In short, how we interpret colors, even how we see them, is more a product of nurture than nature. A few color-coded stories, then. Red. The first color used in art was red, from ochre, and the first known example of cave art was a red ochre plaque, which contains symbolic engravings of triangles, diamond shapes, and lines dated to 75,000 years ago. In the same cave, Blombos, in the western Cape of South Africa, there are suggestions of even older art, including a workshop containing carefully blended paint made from red ochre and marrow fat, along with spatulas and shell mixing dishes. This paint, thought to be used to adorn bodies and perhaps cave walls, has been dated to 100,000 years ago. In almost every country, red seems to have been the first color, other than black and white, to be named with a symbolic appeal often drawn from blood, evoking strength, virility, and fertility. Blue. The world's favorite color is blue, even though it is relatively new to the party linguistically. The ancient Greeks, Chinese, Japanese, and Hebrews did not have a name for blue and thought of it as a version of green. Even today, several languages have green-blue blurring, including Korean, Vietnamese, Thai, Kurdish, Zulu, and Himba. Yet, blue consistently comes first for both men and women in every country where color preference has been surveyed. In one international poll covering 10 countries from 4 continents, it came out well on top in all of them. One reason is that it seems to have a calming effect. Students given IQ tests with blue covers had an edge over a few points over those given tests with red covers. Perhaps because the natural connotation of blue, seas, lakes, rivers, skies. Yellow. This most contrary of colors has long been associated with cowardice. Yellowish bile was thought to make you peevish. And ever since the 8th century, it was the color of anti-Semitism. The Caliph in Medina ordered Jews and Christians to wear yellow badges because it was the color of non-believers. And it spread via Edward I all to Nazi Germany's yellow stars. but it is also the color of defiance in the form of the yellow ribbon, which started with the women's suffrage movement in Kansas in 1867. They chose yellow because the sunflower was the state flower. The 1973 Tony Orlando and Dawn song, "Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree," gave the defiant version of the yellow ribbon an unexpected revival boost. It was later used in protest in the Philippines, Hong Kong, and South Africa. Green. The unusual associations of green relate to the natural world, but it has also picked up some more malign connotations, including envy, jealousy, inexperience, illness, and poison, at least in the comic book bottles. This last meaning came from the pea green pigment called Schlee's Green, used in dyes and paints for carpets, fabrics, wallpaper, ballroom gowns, and confectionery. Problem was that this dye, invented in 1775, contained high doses of, you guessed it, arsenic. It was particularly lethal in wallpaper, releasing tiny particles of arsenic into the air. When Napoleon died in St. Helena in 1821, British were suspected of poisoning him. Later, however, it was discovered that the green wallpaper in his room contained arsenic. This may have hastened his death, but the real cause was bowel cancer and a perforated ulcer. Despite knowledge of its toxicity, it was only in the early 20th century that manufacturers stopped producing Schlee's Green. Orange. The only color in the English language that takes its name from a fruit is orange. It all goes back to China around 4,500 years ago, when oranges were first cultivated and traveled west down the Silk Road. They went to northwest India, where the Sanskrit word for an orange tree, naranga, served as the root for many languages as oranges were planted and sold. Narang in Farsi, naranj in Arabic, and naranja in Spanish. The English word orange is a corruption of the Sanskrit. People mistook a naranja for an aranga or an aranja, and so it evolved into an orange. Before the fruit arrived, the English word for the color was geoloride, or yellow-red, but in the 16th century, orange took over. In some languages, however, the two are separated. In Afrikaans, for example, the color is orange, but the fruit is limon, and several languages, including Himba, Nafana, and Puraha, have no word for the color. Purple. The first color to come in synthetic form was purple. In 1856, William Henry Perkin, an 18-year-old chemist student, was told to conduct an experiment using coal tar to find a cure for malaria. He failed, but was intrigued with what happened when he dipped a piece of cloth into his mixture of coal, aniline, and chromic acid. It came out purple and held its color. He patented the dye he called Malvine and became a rich man after it was mass-produced. Until then, purple had been prohibitively expensive. The ancients needed to crush 12,000 murex sea snails to get 1 gram of Tyrian purple. But the result of Perkins' discovery was the mauve measles, as Punch magazine called the fashion craze. It had a revival in the late 1960s as the color of the counterculture and is now seen as a feminine alternative to pink. Pink. 10 years ago, evolutionary psychologists from the University of Newcastle upon Tyne designed an experiment to test whether pink was an innately feminine color and blue a masculine color. It turned out that blue was favored by both sexes, but that pink had more female support. Their results were heralded as proving that pink was inherently feminine, but this was thrown into doubt when critics protested that this was a recent development. Earlier in the century, women's magazines regularly advised readers to choose pink for boys' clothes. For example, in the 1918, the British Ladies' Home Journal noted, quote, "The generally accepted rule is pink for the boy and blue for the girl. The reason is that pink, being a more decided, stronger color, is more suitable for the boy," end quote. It was only in the 1950s that pink became a decided feminine color through American advertising campaigns. So there's this great little article that talks about the history of color, came out last October in 2019. Again, we'll post a link in the show notes, but how interesting was that? I did write a little bit about the color blue in terms of its kind of recent discovery or recent naming, as it were, for the Midnight Freemasons a while back. I won't read that for you in this episode, probably because I read it before. However, if you're interested, a link in the show notes will be there for you. But let's read about the colors in Freemasonry. While researching the topic, I came across the website for electric495.com, the Electric Lodge, AFNAM, number 495, GRC. This article was written by Brother Leon Zeldis. Let's hear what he has to say. Colors in Freemasonry. It is obvious that colors are a fundamental element of Masonic symbolism when we view aprons, sashes, as well as other items of regalia in our lodge rooms. In some higher degrees, we can observe wall hangings, robes, and other various Masonic accoutrements of various colors. The colors of Masonic aprons may vary in various Masonic jurisdictions, and some do not have what may be considered common, the blue aprons. For example, the Grand Orient of Italy uses green to adorn the Fellowcraft apron, while the Master Mason's is trimmed in red, accompanied by a green sash. It is understood Egypt, influenced by the Italian color, has green aprons. Although green is also connected to Islam, it is also observed some jurisdictions wear the plain white lambskin aprons throughout their service in our craft. The following is a short outline to the symbolism of the various colors that may be seen throughout all Masonic concordant bodies. White. Innocence and purity is exemplified in an image such as the lily or fallen snow. Plato asserts white is the color of the gods. In the volume of Sacred Law, David sees God as a very old man, dressed in robes white as snow. In the New Testament, Peter, James, and John observe Jesus transfigured in clothing which became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. It signifies the beginning and the color of initiation. White is connected with the idea of death and resurrection. Shrouds are white, spirits wear white veils, and it was at one time the color of mourning. White is also the representation of truth and hope, with the white lambskin being the badge of innocence. Blue. Blue represents the blue vault or canopy of heaven. Universally, it denotes immortality, eternity, chastity, and fidelity. While the pale blue represents prudence and goodness, royal blue represents prudence and goodness alone and replaced red at the court in the Middle Ages when that color was given to the lower classes. The color blue became associated with the terms of prestige, such as blue chip and blue blood. In the Holy Bible, we read of white, green, and blue hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple. And thou shalt make the robe of the ephod all of blue. The ancient Jews considered blue a chief religious color, and the high priest wore a blue robe as well as oaths being taken on a blue altar. Purple is a symbol of imperial royalty, richness, and is related to penitence and the solemnity of Lent and Advent in the Christian Church. The Holy Bible as well as the Apocrypha have references to this color. It is spoken of as being a seller's purple, and is stated that they shall spread a purple cloth on the altar. Christ wore a purple robe and a crown of thorns. With the union of blue and red, purple had become the emblem of union. Red, crimson, or scarlet is considered the symbol of fire and heat, and traditionally associated with war and the military. The color of blood is connected with the idea of sacrifice, struggle, and heroism. It signifies charity, devotion, abnegation. In Masonry, it is the emblem of faith, fortitude, fervency, and zeal. On a darker side, it is connected with the flames of hell, appearance of demons, and the apoplectic face of rage. Red, scarlet, and crimson are also shown to signify love, magnanimity, as well as that of martyrdom. Green is directly associated with the idea of resurrection and immortality. The acacia, occasionally referred to as the Masonic evergreen, has been suggested as a symbol of a moral life and rebirth as well as immortality. The ancient Egyptians used it as a symbol of hope. It is always regarded as the symbol of gladness and abundance. Yellow. While this color is rarely observed in a lodge room, it has been said to be a symbol of wisdom. As the rays of the sun enlighten the day, the candidate of the Fellowcraft degree is enlightened educationally. Because in this degree, we, for the first time, instruct a mace in the science of art. It represents both the best and the worst in man, the color of brass and honey, as well as sulfur and cowardice. It reflects the golden age, golden apples, and the quality of the golden fleece. It was the color of the patch imposed on the Jews and referred to as the badge of infamy. It reminds us of the sun and of gold. Yellow and gold, as well as silver, is said to have been used in Freemasonry since gold is the symbol of the sun while silver is that of the moon. Universally, yellow represents jealousy, incontinence, and treachery, although in Masonry it is said to represent the color of gold and its meaning is reversed. Black is one of the fundamental colors found in all civilizations dating back to the Middle Ages. The Knights of Malta wore black. Traditionally, it has become the color representing darkness or death, although black was not introduced as a symbol of mourning until after the middle of the 14th century. The black stone of Mecca is believed by Muslims to have at one time been white, the sins of man causing the transformation. It has always been a symbol of grief and sorrow as well as that of death. Leon Zeldis. Well, there you have a couple of pieces on color. Now, for some additional reference on color, there is another article that I will point to and add to the show notes. It is The Significance of Masonic Colors, written by Brother Harold A. Kingsbury of Massachusetts for The Builder magazine back in July of 1919. I'll leave that for you to check out. For a Craftsman Plus out there, let's just ask a simple question this week and make it as complex as you want. The question is, what other Masonic colors are there? And if you can't think of any, what are some possible symbolic or philosophical meanings behind some of the colors that we've talked about or that we haven't that you can make a good argument for? I'd love to hear what you have to say. Let's check it out in those posts right there in our Craftsman Plus Facebook group. For those of you who listen week after week and don't know what the Craftsman Plus Facebook group is, for those people who support this program, you can request to join the Facebook group, and we'll just check to make sure you're one of the contributors to the show, and we'll go ahead and let you in. There's some great conversations that happen there, and you know, it is a great place to get advice, talk to other brothers who are kind of really interested in some of the topics that we talk about on the show. And we just continue the conversation there, so it's a lot of fun. That's it for this week. I want to thank everybody who has joined us. I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and our legacy partners, those people who share the program and, of course, make one-time donations to bring this program, almost 10 years now, to anybody interested in Freemasonry, or again, as Mackey would call it, and its kindred sciences, to anybody out there listening. You know, we've got over 2 million downloads just in audio. That doesn't even count the people who are watching on YouTube. These things and these topics of a philosophical manner and deeper significance to the human experience are popular today. People want this information, and I'm just happy to be able to assist in bringing it out there and showcasing articles and things that are timeless. And so, again, I want to thank everybody for joining and listening to the program. Get ready for Esotericon. There are great presenters happening. I can't wait to watch. I'm going to watch them with my good friend Joe Martinez and family down out there in Virginia. I'm going to get to see, hopefully, I'll get to see Jason Richards and John and see Kevin Holman and some of the other fellows down there. Really looking forward to seeing everybody. It is not an in-person engagement. It is via Zoom. So if you're going to attend, awesome. Maybe I'll see you on the little screen or something. Shortly after that, of course, I've got a few presentations happening toward the middle of the month after the 10th. So more on that next week. But for now, that's it. So we'll talk to you all next week. Stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.